I'm Rebecca Ibarra, host of NPR and WNYC's Consider This, in for Tanzina Vega, and you're listening to The Takeaway. On Wednesday afternoon, President Joe Biden traveled to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, to unveil his $2 trillion plan to boost the economy and rebuild infrastructure across the U.S.
I'm proposing a plan for the nation that rewards work, not just rewards wealth. It builds a fair economy that gives everybody a chance to succeed and is going to create the strongest, most resilient, innovative economy in the world.
The sweeping proposal called the American Jobs Plan is part of President Biden's Build Back Better agenda, set to tackle everything from the ongoing climate crisis to job creation to improving infrastructure like roads, bridges, and highways. At least $400 billion will be set aside for the, quote, caregiving economy, with major investments in child and elder care access. Even more investment in caregiving infrastructure is expected in the coming weeks as the Biden administration prepares to release a second part of the package. As we've reported on this show, the COVID-19 pandemic has brought the nation's caregiving crisis to the fore as millions of women, particularly women of color, have had to leave the workforce to take on childcare and other caregiving responsibilities over the past year. So today on The Takeaway, the caregiving economy is where we start. Joining us now is C. Nicole Mason, the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Institute for Women's Policy Research. Nicole, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Rebecca. Glad to be here.
So let's start by saying, how do we define the care or caregiving economy?
So the caregiving economy is quite simple. It's just people caring for other people, for children, whether at home, daycare, or school, for parents and grandparents, for the sick or disabled. That is the definition of the caregiving. The people who work and provide those services are a part of the caregiving economy.
So, Nicole, it's interesting that investments in caregiving were lumped together with more traditional forms of infrastructure like bridges and roads. Why don't we usually think about childcare infrastructure the same way we think about physical infrastructure?
Well, you know, this is a really historic shift in our thinking about care. What happened during the pandemic is we understood that care is a big part of infrastructure. And without a solid care system, women have fallen out of the workforce. Kids are not able to, you know, because they've been out of school and have not had reliable care. It really impacts, again, labor force participation. And we also understand that those workers who were providing care were also hit really hard by the pandemic. And we, as advocates, have really encouraged the administration to broaden our definition of infrastructure to include the care economy and not just roads and railways, like the traditional definition of infrastructure.
Do you think the pandemic is, you know, changing or even radically changing our perception of caregiving?
Absolutely. I think that, the pandemic has been devastating, there's no doubt. But what it is allowed to do is accelerate many of the conversations that many of us have been having around the care economy and its significance. And it allowed this issue to come into sharp focus as a result of the pandemic, because we couldn't deny the role of caregivers, the role of care in terms of families needed in order to be able to work and the impact it had on women in the workforce. And so the pandemic has accelerated that conversation. And I have to say that I don't believe that we would have been having the conversation had it not been for the pandemic in this way.
So, Nicole, let's talk about some specifics in the American Jobs Plan. What does the proposal include for those who need care?
So it's a $400 billion investment in the care economy, mainly to increase quality, access, and raise wages for workers. And I have to say that the care economy and the workers are one of the most underpaid sectors. And so when the pandemic hit, these workers were really vulnerable because of the lower wages and the low quality of the job. So no benefits, no paid sick leave. Many businesses had to close their doors. And what that did was increase the scarcity of availability, the availability of care. So this $400 billion investment, $400 billion investment will go a long way to strengthening the care infrastructure overall.
Tell us about what it will mean for older people and people with disabilities seeking at-home or community-based care.
Well, it would expand the availability of care, because it's really, first of all, care is exorbitantly expensive, especially for the elderly and people who have disabilities. And so what this does is increase the availability, lower costs for families, and also provide higher wages for workers. So, very excited about the investments there and hoping that this is not the end of those kinds of investments, because, you know, we've underinvested for so long that this $400 billion will go a long way. But we're going to need continued investment.
So you mentioned higher wages. What else does the American Jobs Plan outline when it comes to those providing the care?
Well, it raising wages, hopefully getting, other benefits like paid sick leave. Again, making sure increasing the availability and accessibility of care is really critically important. And what I'm also hoping is that this is an opportunity for us to make some changes to how we, who is eligible to receive payment for care. So making sure, perhaps making sure that family members who provide care in their homes to family members or those with disabilities, that they're able to be reimbursed and paid for their services as well.
So, Nicole, what do you think has informed the Biden administration's approach to the care economy?
So I'm really excited to say that it's really been the advocates on the ground, like Ai-Jen Poo, Domestic Workers Alliance, and Caring Across Generations, the National Women's Law Center, and many other advocates who have been beating this drum for a very long time. I mean, over a decade. And, the Biden administration is listening to those experts. I was reading an article, it's so funny, in the Wall Street Journal, and it said, why isn't Biden listening to the experts? And by experts, they meant Larry Summers and that bunch. And I said, well, he is listening to the experts. He's listening to the people who have been doing this work and understand the magnitude of this problem and the disproportionate impact it's had on women and communities of color, and centering those voices. And that's really been the game changer, at least in this package.
I wonder if there are models maybe from the private sector or other states or elsewhere that the Biden administration has based its caregiving investments on.
Well, I would like to say that that is the case, but we also have to know that the private sector has not been leading in this area. So it's really hard to take lessons from an industry that's a little bit far behind, a sector that's a little far behind. I know firsthand that he has been in round the clock meetings with advocates who have been doing this work for a long time. Again, Ai-Jen Poo, Moms Rising, Time's Up, and many of us who have been beating this drum, IWPR included, providing some of the critical research in this area. So, everybody does have a role to play in helping to shape this plan and this policy. But I think this is the first time, at least I've been doing this work for 30 years, where I feel like the voices of those who are most impacted are front and center in these conversations.
And so then historically, what have been the barriers to getting major reforms on caregiving policies in the U.S.?
Well, unfortunately, we haven't prioritized care in the U.S. We believe that it's women's obligation and duty to provide care without complaint. And the caregiving system was not working for many working women and their families. And when the pandemic hit, it became very clear that this is a crisis and we had a really broken system. And many women had, myself included, sort of internalized the problem of care and believed it was our fault and our issue to solve. And the pandemic, what it has done is from corporate moms to moms on the front line, we've started to see that it's not an individual problem. This is a structural institutional problem that deserves government attention. And treating childcare or care as a public good rather than a private obligation of families.
Mm. So we know that millions of women left the workforce during the pandemic. Is there anything in the American Jobs Plan that will help them get back to work?
Well, this pieces of this care of this rescue plan, especially around care, the care economy will help. I think we do need more, I have to say. Hmm. I really would like to see us have a national care infrastructure. This piece of the program focuses on workers and strengthening the workforce. I do believe that we need to go a bit further and do what other countries are doing and investing in our child and family care policies, making sure that no family spends more than 7% of their income on care. Families can now spend up to 30% or more on care, making it universally accessible. The other part of Biden's plan, he extends care to 3 and 4 year olds. I would like to see it from zero from birth on. That's just, the U.S. spends less than 1% of its GDP on family care and child care policies. We're only behind Ireland and we're only above Ireland and Turkey. That seems unacceptable in the wealthiest country in the world. So I think Biden is on the right track in terms of, working to make us competitive, globally. And I think creating a national child care infrastructure and will go a long way to getting women back into the workforce and allowing them to sustain employment.
And in the 20 seconds we have left, the Biden administration will be announcing a second piece of this plan in the coming weeks. What should we expect to see from that, especially related to the care economy?
Well, we're going to see, again, a strengthening of the care economy. It's going to focus on more of the expansion of infrastructure and focus on the care economy. And so that's going to go a long way. Again, I would like to see some focus on helping families. So in addition to supporting workers and improving accessibility, also supporting women reentering the workforce.
C. Nicole Mason is the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Institute for Women's Policy Research. Nicole, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Here to walk us through more on all of this is Jeff Stein, White House economics reporter for The Washington Post. Jeff, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to be on.
So did anything surprise you about the American Jobs Plan, or was it more or less in line with what Biden promised on the campaign trail?
That's a good question. Biden on the campaign trail announced his Build Back Better agenda, but it wasn't really clear. It included different components that we saw yesterday, but this was a much more specific delineation of the priorities that he is going to push in his sort of first big post-COVID domestic set of priorities. And while in some ways the plan shrunk, Biden initially called for $2 trillion in clean energy spending over 4 years. And this is about that over 8 years, so a smaller per year impact. In many ways, he's really putting forward many of the same campaign commitments in an aggressive way and really pushing the boundaries of what we've seen Democrats promise on climate. It's quite a sea change from the Obama years, in which climate was often seen as sort of an anti-jobs issue that, whether it was fair or not, the Obama plans were often characterized as limiting jobs, as limiting economic growth. And Biden, in marketing this quite successfully so far, at least as an infrastructure and jobs plan that has a climate component, is really flipping that dynamic on its head in a very interesting way.
Huh. Jeff, how does what's being proposed in this plan on caregiving compare to the $1.9 trillion COVID aid package President Biden signed into law in early March?
The relief plan signed by President Biden in March really had very little, if anything, to do with caregiving. As your prior guest accurately noted, this is about $400 billion. Although I will say the plan released yesterday by the Biden White House is remarkably vague on exactly what it wants to do for the caregiving economy. There's basically no policy substance that I can tell. It has some aspirational goals, including, you know, making sure that caretakers are better paid for and that home care is prioritized, so people do not feel the need to go into a nursing home if they prefer to age in their homes, which many of the experts I talked to say is also cheaper for the federal government. So some clear policy goals here, but how that money would be allocated, where it would go precisely, how it would work. It's really only a few lines on a sheet of paper just saying that they want to do something big. And I am spending a lot of my time trying to get to the bottom of what this actually looks like.
Huh. Remarkably vague. Will any specifics be addressed in the second part of this package, expected in April, maybe?
I would say no. So that is going to be, the second package is going to have different priorities. It will have childcare and paid family medical leave and college tuition. What the White House is likely doing, or almost certainly doing, is saying we want, you know, $400 billion or a major investment in caretakers, and we'll sort of punt the specifics to Congress. And sort of, you guys figure out exactly how you want to do this, but we want to do something big on this front. The second package will probably include, you know, similar aspirational goals around child care and paid leave and these other priorities, but may also not include sort of the granular specifics on how that funding would actually work. I mean, I don't mean to diminish the significance at all of this investment. As the guest noted, you know, we are dealing with a massive crisis in which women in particular and daughters are bearing the brunt of our, you know, America is exceptionally unique in not providing elder care and home care as a right to people who are senior citizens. And as we have the aging of the baby boomers, we are in for a real, real challenge. And so I don't mean to say that the White House embracing this and prioritizing it in a very, you know, just talking to the White House, they have dozens of, you know, activists and advocates and lawmakers and unions and business groups constantly asking for this or that. Mm. And they don't have that much money to play with. And the fact that they're saying that 1/5 of this plan is going to go to home care is really stunning. I mean, it's just a recognition of how seriously they're taking this, but we really still don't know exactly how it will work.
Let's also talk about some of the other infrastructure plans laid out in the proposal. A big chunk of the proposal will go toward physical infrastructure like highways and roads. So how substantial will the upgrade to our nation's infrastructure be?
It's funny because, you know, there's this debate over what the word infrastructure means. And if you think about it, it's quite a capacious term. The White House has continued to say, you know, well, you know, this is human infrastructure, which may not be how many people think about it, but is not necessarily illegitimate. It sort of set off quite a bit of joking on Capitol Hill, you know, people trying to think about how they can recast their proposals. You know, I tweeted about this today, but someone was joking that, you know, they should call Medicare for All, you know, a healthcare infrastructure proposal. Maybe court packing and adding justices to the Supreme Court could be a court infrastructure, a judicial infrastructure proposal. So the flexibility of the term, which is itself very popular, has opened this window for a lot of people to put different priorities in there. To your main point, let me just try to, I know there's so, it's so big and so hard to do this in a concise way, but very quickly, there's about $650 billion devoted to sort of traditional physical infrastructure, such as roads, bridges, ports, waterways, that kind of thing. And then there's several other huge pots. So about $200 billion for housing, $100 billion for broadband, $100 billion for the electrical grid, tens of billions of dollars for other critical infrastructure needs. And so, you know, it's hard to sum up exactly, but those are some of the main ones that the White House is talking about. They're saying that under this proposal, you know, there would be, electric vehicle charging stations everywhere in the country. Every lead pipe in America would be replaced. Every American could have access to high speed, affordable broadband by the end of the decade. So some very, very big promises here.
And in the, 30 seconds we have left, what roadblocks will this plan face moving forward?
Progressive Democrats already, I spoke to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She thinks, you know, that the framework is basically right, that this is on the right track in terms of the priorities, but that the overall dollar amounts are really not enough to meet the 1.5 degrees of warming that's very dangerous for the planet. So we'll see if they mobilize.
Jeff Stein is the White House economics reporter for The Washington Post. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The trial of Derek Chauvin began this week, and it's had an emotional start.
It's been nights. I stayed up apologizing to George Floyd for not doing more.
That was Darnella Frazier, the young witness who recorded the now famous video of George Floyd's death. Chauvin is facing three charges: second-degree unintentional murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter. His trial is expected to go for 4 weeks, with the jury expected to begin deliberating in late April or early May. Joining us to go through what we've heard this week is Brant Williams, correspondent for Minnesota Public Radio News, covering public safety, criminal justice, and racial disparities. Brant, welcome back to The Takeaway.
I'm glad to be here.
Let's start with the first day. How did the prosecution present their opening statements?
Well, the prosecution started by laying out their strategy to basically base their case on a couple different major elements. They're going to use medical experts, use of force experts, and rely on that video. They're going to use their medical experts to show that Floyd died because he couldn't breathe and that he didn't die from a drug overdose. They're going to use these use of force experts. They're going to show that Derek Chauvin did not follow the way police officers are trained to handle these types of situations. And he also laid out that they're going to rely on the video, which, of course, many of us have seen and many of us can't unsee. That's going to play a major part in this case.
Yeah, you mentioned drug overdose. So tell us how the defense tried to present what happened that day in Minneapolis.
So the defense attorney, Eric Nielsen, laid out a case that he said will point to medical evidence, which will show that George Floyd did not die from a positional asphyxia caused by the force used by Derek Chauvin. They're going to go to evidence that will show that Floyd had a history of hypertension and heart troubles that were complicated by his ingestion of drugs. And he said, basically, it acted to further compromise an already compromised heart. So that is going to be at the heart of their case.
So the first day, a 911 dispatcher testified. Tell us what she said.
So she told the court and the jurors about basically what she saw on that day as she was doing her job, and she was dispatching calls in the background at the center where she works. She mentioned that there was video screens, and she could see officers there at the scene. And she told the jurors that, you know, she was concerned because it was taking so long, that there was this incident happening. And so she actually called a sergeant to let the sergeant know that it appeared that there was a use of force incident happening and that he should know about it.
And some of the witnesses this week have had to have their identities hidden because of their age. Tell us about these young witnesses and the testimony they provided.
Right. The judge said because these young people were minors at the time last year, two of them are now 18, but there are a couple that are still minors. He allowed basically that we could hear their voices but not see them, and we would only know them by their first names. This, of course, as you can imagine, was very emotional testimony. Mm-hmm. You had young people experiencing seeing somebody losing their life right in front of them. And so, and one of those, of course, was Darnella Frazier, who we now know because she's the young woman who posted that viral video. Mm-hmm. And she described what it was like for her seeing George Floyd on the ground and the feeling of helplessness. She felt a sense of responsibility or guilt that she didn't do anything more to help him. And she said to the jurors that at night she would apologize to George Floyd, saying, "I wish I could have done more for you."
Brant, there was also another witness who testified, an off-duty firefighter who was present at the scene. What happened when she took the stand?
Right. We're talking about Genevieve Hansen. She was an off-duty firefighter who had just happened upon the scene. And she had some very powerful testimony. She is an EMT. She knows, she's been trained how to identify people who are in medical distress and things that, that you can do to help someone. And she testified that she had this feeling of frustration and helplessness that she tried to, she felt like she could help. She was telling the officers that this man appears to be in distress and asked them or told them, you need to get him some help. And in her testimony was, I think was very strong in that she was someone who had the experience and knowledge that could have stepped in and done something. And she broke down. She cried on the stand because, as she said, she felt very frustrated and very helpless.
There was also testimony from the store clerk who interacted with Floyd before his death. What did the store clerk have to say about their interaction?
Right. This young man, a 19-year-old, a man named Christopher Martin, he said that he interacted with George Floyd in the store. And at the time they played some of the store videos, you could see George Floyd walking through the store. There was no audio, but you could see him alive and walking around. And that was a point where one of the pool reporters in the courtroom said they noticed jurors really paying close attention to this, seeing George Floyd interact. Christopher Martin said it appeared that George Floyd was high on something he didn't know. But he said he was nice. He was cordial. And, you know, Christopher Martin said that he got this $20 bill. And at first he didn't, he thought, okay, this looks like it's a fake bill. He said he wrestled with the idea of, you know, should he tell somebody about it or should he just accept it and eat it? But he did tell his manager, and that led to the back and forth. He was told to go out and tell George Floyd to come back in the store. And Mr. Martin just said after, you know, during his testimony that after seeing what happened to George Floyd after that, that he felt some sense of guilt and responsibility. He felt like if he hadn't of made a big deal about the $20 bill, that this wouldn't have happened at all. And I think that may have been some powerful testimony, seeing this young man dealing with these feelings of guilt.
And for the first time, we got to see yesterday body camera footage from Chauvin himself. Brant, what did we learn from that?
So, yeah, that video was very illustrative of the scene. It you got a sense of it's that hand-to-hand combat, close quarters, struggling with George Floyd. You can hear more of detail of George Floyd's pleading for, he said, "I can't breathe," and kept pleading and pleading. And so we're right there hearing, you can almost feel his breath as you know, the struggle goes on and these officers are trying to get him onto the ground and keep him down. You can see his the muscles in his arms straining against the holds that the officers are putting on him. We have a pool reporter that we share who is in the courtroom who is watching as Rodney Floyd, one of George Floyd's brothers, was shaking his head and reacting in a way that he was very upset by looking at this. So that was very, very impactful testimony, the video.
Lastly, Brant, what can we expect to see in the coming days for the trial?
So, as we mentioned, the prosecution is going to be relying on a bunch of different types of evidence in their case. So at some point, we're going to start to see, I imagine, police use of force experts who are going to be able to testify about the actions that Chauvin and the other officers took. And because the state is trying to show that Chauvin was not following police protocols and was actually endangering the life of George Floyd by putting his knee into him for that long.
Brant Williams is a correspondent for Minnesota Public Radio News covering public safety, criminal justice, and racial disparities. Brant, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
after the police killing of George Floyd and the racial justice uprisings that followed across the country, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo signed an executive action pushing for policing changes at the local level. The order required every locality with a police department to submit a reform plan by today, April 1st, or risk losing state funding. But while this might seem like a comprehensive policing overhaul, some critics of the order argue that it doesn't do nearly enough. Governor Cuomo gave no real blueprint for what the reform plans need to include, leaving communities to decide what changes to make on their own. Here with us now is George Joseph, an investigative reporter with WNYC's Race and Justice Unit. Good to have you here, George.
Hey, Rebecca.
So what exactly does this executive order require from cities and towns in New York?
So, you know, last year after the massive Black Lives Matter protests, Governor Cuomo tried to sort of implement his own vision of police reform. But because so much of policing is sort of controlled at the local level, he used sort of his power of the purse at the state level to say, look, every single municipality across the state, which is over 500 of them, needs to submit a reform plan by April 1st. And if you don't, you may lose state funding, which is really important to some departments across the state.
And how varied are the different plans that the localities have put out?
So Governor Cuomo's sort of letter to these executives at the local level didn't really specify very much. It listed numerous things they could consider to change. For example, use of force, restorative justice, you know, focused deterrence. You know, there's so many different types of ideas that localities could use here. But all they really said sort of as a structure is that localities have to reach out to locals, meet with community groups, come up with a plan, get the plan ratified, and then submit to the state. But there's no clear criterion of you need to do X, Y, and Z because that meets best practices. So what we're seeing across the state is it really all comes down to the politics, the political will, and frankly, sort of the knowledge base of locals on how they're going to change their departments.
Were there any other localities that were more resistant to putting together any comprehensive reform policies?
You know, that varies across the state. We've seen in sort of small towns, especially upstate, some resistance at these town halls from police chiefs where, you know, someone will say that police are racist and then the chief will say, no, we don't have that problem here. But, you know, even in the biggest police department in New York City, the NYPD, where there have been tons of protests and there are tons of sort of reform organizations, the changes haven't been as dramatic in the city as in other parts of the state. You know, some of the stuff that the NYPD is implementing in response to this are, you know, implicit bias training, more diversity in the force. These are initiatives that had already been tried before and are sort of ongoing for the NYPD. They're not necessarily the sort of radical defunding stuff that activists were calling for, although there is some shifting of funding in New York to a small degree.
So then what actually happens if an agency doesn't have their plan ready by today or if the governor doesn't approve of the plans they made?
So we have to wait and see on that. Thus far, it's too early to sort of say that, you know, the governor is going to reject any of these plans. You know, that would really depend on the governor's political calculus if he wants to take a harder stand on what localities need to do. Some critics felt like this was just a way for the governor to show that he was making a change by requiring these reforms, but by not really giving any rules about it, you know, basically allowing localities to do whatever they wanted to do.
Huh. I have a feeling I'll know the answer to this question. But George, you've been reporting on corruption in police departments in the state. Will this address anything related to corruption in those police departments?
You know, again, it really depends on the local political will. For example, one of the places that I've reported on is a small town called Mount Vernon. And in Mount Vernon, which is a fairly, you know, not super well-funded police force, they are using this opportunity as a way to kind of modernize. So they're finally, you know, proposing things that people in big cities may consider basics, like body cameras or public information officers for their department to, you know, help the public understand what's going on with the police department. You know, these things sound like basics, but we have to remember so much of American policing is decided at the local levels in small cities and towns. And so in some ways, this push is not just to reform, it's to modernize.
And apart from this executive order, what else has New York State done to address police brutality and corruption since last summer?
There's been quite a bit of activity at the legislative level. You know, listeners may not be aware that for decades, New York had much stricter laws protecting disciplinary records for police from coming out, you know, even as compared to other states like Texas and Florida. So one of the big changes right after the George Floyd protest was that the legislature repealed one of those secrecy laws. And now cities across the state, from Rochester down to New York City, have been putting out sort of thousands of documents, finally going back years on police misconduct findings.
So now that these plans are in, what are you watching for next when it comes to policing in New York, George?
Well, there's so much that reform advocates still want. One thing I'm watching in particular is sort of on the surveillance side of things. You know, in recent years, there's been such a sort of quiet adoption of technologies like DNA databases and facial recognition software, often in partnership with private companies. But there's very little regulation, especially at the state level, for the use of these technologies and how police are using them in their criminal investigations. So we'll see if advocates and privacy rights advocates' calls for more regulation of those technologies finally comes to fruition.
George Joseph is an investigative reporter for WNYC's Race and Justice Unit. Thanks so much for joining us, George.
Thank you.
As we just heard, today is the deadline for every city and town in New York State to submit police reform plans to Governor Andrew Cuomo. The City Council of Rochester, New York, voted to approve their city's plan earlier this week. Here's Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren at a conference outlining the proposed overhauls in February.
My uncle was the first person to receive compensation from a lawsuit that he had filed against the city of Rochester for police officers brutally beating him back in the 1960s. So this work is very, very important to me. It is personal to me. It is personal to my family. And I want to get it right for all of you, the citizens of Rochester.
This all comes at a moment when the Rochester Police Department is facing increased public scrutiny. Over the past year, Rochester police officers have been at the center of multiple high-profile incidents of police brutality, including the killing of Daniel Prude in March of 2020 and the pepper spraying of a 9-year-old girl earlier this year. But according to the civilian-led Rochester Police Accountability Board, the city's police reform plans are unlikely to create meaningful change within Rochester. Here with us now is Connor Dwyer Reynolds, Executive Director of the Rochester Police Accountability Board. Thanks for being here, Connor.
Rebecca, wonderful to be with you.
First off, what should people know about the role of Police Accountability Board in Rochester?
You know, we're a community-led organization dedicated to establishing community control of our police department and our public safety system.
And for listeners who aren't familiar with Rochester, how distinct is the city's police department compared to other similarly sized cities?
You know, we're an outlier. You know, compared to about the 75 cities closest to us in size, we have twice as many officers. You know, the only city nearly our size that has more officers is Birmingham, Alabama.
Wow. So last year, the Police Accountability Board put out a proposal detailing changes you wanted to see for policing in Rochester. So what were some of the key pieces of that proposal?
You know, the heart of that proposal was that the community wanted fundamental change rather than piecemeal reform. And community clearly spoke up and wanted immediate millions of dollars investments in alternative first responder programs that put social workers and mental health providers on the front lines. They wanted to remove white supremacy from institutions of policing and public safety. And they wanted the community to be leading when it comes to reshaping the public safety budget to ensure we have an equitable system in Rochester.
You say remove white supremacy. What does that look like in action?
It's a couple of things. It's making sure that we're screening out white supremacists from our public safety forces, including our police department, as well as looking at the systems and rules that enforce things like white supremacy in our city when it comes to enforcement patterns like stop and frisk and other practices.
So, Connor, how does the city's plan compare to your proposal?
You know, there's a lot of things missing from the city's plan in our proposal. You know, some of the most important things that we pushed for were concrete deadlines and hard funding commitments to make sure that the public knew that real change would actually get implemented. A lot of the proposals in the current plan that the city submits are pretty vague, saying, we'll do things in some years to come, but not specify what the exact things will be, and commitments to say that they'll increase funding to programs without giving dollar signs.
So how are you feeling about the proposed plan then?
Well, it's an election year. And so, these plans come out pretty often whenever there's an incident of police brutality. And I think what Rochesterians want are investments in the current institutions that are community-led that are already dedicated to creating fundamental changes, plans for change and reform, and for ensuring that officer misconduct is addressed quickly, fairly, and transparently. And that's what we have in the Police Accountability Board, which was, created by an overwhelming referendum supported by Rochesterians in 2019. And so, any plan that doesn't, fully support and fund the existing Police Accountability Board, I'm not sure that Rochesterians should have a ton of faith that, vague promises are going to do a ton.
We mentioned the killing of Daniel Prude, as well as the incident from this year where an officer pepper sprayed a 9-year-old girl. Both Prude and the girl were Black. So have there been any significant changes within Rochester's police department in response to either of those incidents?
The Rochester Police Department has been rolling out some new policies, like things like a duty to intervene to make sure that officers respond when others are doing wrong, things like de-escalation policies and practices. But the trouble with rolling out new policies is that, anyone who's involved in policing knows that new policies are just words on paper unless there's sustained training on the front end to make sure officers understand what they're supposed to do, and then disciplinary policies on the back end to make sure that rules are followed. We haven't seen those things yet from the Rochester Police Department. So right now, we can't be sure that any of the changes that the police are doing to kind of reform themselves are actually creating change.
So the Police Accountability Board says that Rochester residents want a fundamental overhaul of public safety in your city. Is that true across the board for white residents as well as Black and brown residents?
I think that, in any community, we can't characterize them as monoliths. But the important mm-hmm. thing to remember is that something that hopefully makes this moment different is you do see across racial and demographic groups real support for concrete change. Now, we saw thousands and thousands of Rochesterians take to the streets over the last year. The community standing up united to say something needs to change across our system. They overwhelmingly supported the Rochester Police Accountability Board too. That's why I have faith that in the short to medium term, we will have fundamental change in Rochester.
How fully have Rochester officials acknowledged the role that racism plays in the city's criminal justice system?
It's been hard. The Police Accountability Board is very focused on talking about things like white supremacy, systemic racism, misogyny, these kind of structural oppression that really gets to the heart of what the problems with our system are. And I think it's been hard to get people to, say those phrases and words, but it takes more than just saying them. It takes having policies, procedures, practices that constantly center these ideas and then attacks them frontally. And so we're kind of a long ways away from really getting to the place where we need to be when confronting these structural issues in our public safety system in Rochester.
So then, Connor, what needs to happen going forward to create lasting change for policing in Rochester, according to you and the board?
The board is so focused on making sure that the community's voices get heard. When we were developing our policy, our proposals for change, we went out and specifically solicited the voices of unhoused people, Black and brown people, former officers, formerly incarcerated people. These are the groups that see the most when it comes to policing, and they're the voices that need to be centered. And so I think that what the Rochester Police Accountability Board is looking for is systems of empowerment, ways of doing government differently. Because when we talk about policing, it can be easy to just focus narrowly on things like, you know, incidents of police brutality. But in cities across the country, the most powerful and largest part of government is policing. So when we talk about changing policing, what we're talking about is changing the fundamentals of government and politics. And so if we don't have an approach that empowers ordinary people when it comes to policing reform, I doubt that we're going to see actual lasting fundamental changes to our cities across New York.
Connor Dwyer Reynolds is the executive director of the Rochester Police Accountability Board. Thanks so much, Connor.
It's wonderful to be in here. Take care.
That's our show for Thursday, folks. We want to hear your thoughts. Call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Rebecca Ibarra in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.